Just a note on accessibility. From now on, we are uploading music-free versions of each episode. You can find those at our blog, jetpack.zoob.net or jetpack.zoob.net. The blog post for each episode features an embedded player with a music-free version. And you can also find transcripts of a number of our episodes pinned to the top of the blog.
This episode is sponsored by Soylent and Spirulina Shakes. Unlike your unhealthy bright green sodas, this product is dark green, so it's got to be good for you. With all natural ingredients grown in the slums of New York, Soylent Green is
the color of the goblins, the color of sap. Till she appeared to him as she really was, horrible and mocking.
Changed into what?
Half man, half plant, the goblin's favorite food.
Food? Don't tell me they ate him, Grandpa.
That's exactly what happened, with a voracity that has no equal on Earth.
We apologize for that interruption. Soylent and Spirulina Shakes are a product of Vertical Corp, who supply food for half the world. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/verticalcorp.
Do you like it? Shall we eat it together?
What kind of show is this?
Just a spoiler warning for ABC Family's Huge and What We Do in the Shadows.
Happy Pride. Welcome to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with homophile leanings. I'm Ani White, on the line to my bearishly burly pansexual co-host Derek Johnson.
Thank you, my homophile Ani. And again, happy Pride to all our listeners. For our second Pride Month episode, we're discussing the career of one Harvey Guillen, a gay plus-size Latino actor and male model.
Yeah, I've watched Guillen's career with interest since he starred in the fairly obscure teen show Huge over 10 years ago. And now he's finally made it with his prominent role in the sitcom What We Do in Shadows. So we're celebrating with his career with a couple of reviews. I'll overanalyze Huge, then we'll skip forward 10 years and discuss What We Do in the Shadows. But first, some recs, Derek.
Yes, I'm going to rec the documentary about James Baldwin, I Am Not Your Negro, directed by Raoul Peck.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And Baldwin's writing itself is also pretty fundamental. Giovanni's Room is a gay classic, and he's also written a lot of good nonfiction analysis, which is what the movie mostly draws on and kind of sets that to stock footage. And anything by Raoul Peck is generally worth a watch.
And the second was Major, with exclamation point at the end, which is a documentary that you can find on Amazon Prime and other places. For over 40 years, African-American transgender woman, veteran of the Stonewall Rebellion, survivor of Attica State Prison, a former sex worker, an elder, and a community leader, and human rights activist, Miss Major Griffin Gracie, has spoken openly about empowering transgender people. In Major, she recounts her life and the fight for human rights for people in her community.
And on topic, my first rec is Harvey Guillen's work as a plus-size male model. You could probably just Google image search Harvey Guillen modeling, but I'll link to a particularly lovely example from Chubster, a plus-size men's website. And if, like me, you're into that sort of thing, I also recommend the Bear City trilogy, which has a veritable buffet of men. It's technically not porn, no full frontal, but it is the sort of thing where Santa Claus gets grinded on a sex swing by another bearded daddy in the middle of the woods. Then you just don't exactly see all of the parts. So although the dramatic side of the series can be a little corny, it caters to its target audience very well. You can rent or buy the Bear City flicks digitally at bearcity.com for less than $10 a piece, and there's also some merch at that website. And for any gay gamers, the classic gay dating sim Dream Daddy, another one with a cornucopia of men for all tastes, from goth to muso to bear, and even for some reason a blonde waspy Christian. So I guess if that's your thing, go for it. Finally, I recommend the Big Fat Gay podcast. So the hosts describe themselves as two chubs, two chasers, two millennials, two Gen Xers, two experts, two laymen, commenting on issues that fat people and their admirers face in relationships, media, and society. And it has kind of a gay focus along with that. It's sharp, funny, and affirming. They also have an annual awards episode called The Chubbies. Definitely the best name for any awards ceremony around. And that's for work promoting body diversity and fat positivity. And finally, lest any socialist listeners accuse us of dreaded bourgeois identity politics, I'm going to recommend John D'Amelio's classic text, Capitalism and Gay Identity, which I originally read in the fascinating collection The Material Queer, which sought to bring historical materialism and queer theory together. D'Amelio's essay looks at the historical basis of the formation of modern gay identity, particularly the transition from peasant society to wage labour, allowing the formation of new urban communities, new kinds of families, as it were.
And also in conjunction with the topic of Harvey Guillen and his show that he's on currently, he did a live Reddit AMA, and there's the video of it on his Before the Shadows YouTube channel. And there's a nice video history about Polari, the Secret Language of Gays by Zoe Baker, and Why TERFs Misunderstand the Handmaid's Tale by Jesse Gender. All are very good.
As always, we'll link all of these recs in the blog description for this episode at jetpack.zoob.net.
For your meat space recs, embrace your kinks and preferences, ensure enthusiastic consent, and get checked for STIs.
All over the country, would-be TV companies plan for the day when they might get a license to operate. Now, the one that most interested me was called Boner TV Limited. And to find out more about them, I paid a visit to their headquarters, which is actually the cloakroom of the Marine Commando Club Paddington. Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian. This is my friend Sandy.
Oh, hello.
Sam. Winter base now, quick, it's Mr. Orne.
These are the registered offices of Boner Television.
Well, it's an odd place to run a TV company.
We haven't the money for bigger premises. We're hoping to save enough out of tips.
Now, which area are you after?
Oh. Well, not one of the big ones. No. To be frank, we haven't the modus operandi to service a big area, have we, Sam?
No, particularly when you consider that these are our studios, too.
Yes.
You see. Mm. You see, Mr. Orne, Granada covers the North, ATV covers the Midlands. We're going after the area where we have special associations.
Mincing Lane.
Oh!
So first, we're going to talk about Harvey Guillen's debut role. In 2010, a short-lived series was released on ABC Family, a teen drama set at a fat camp called Huge. The series is created by Savannah Dooley, daughter of Winnie Holzman, who created the brilliant teen melodrama My So-Called Life. Huge starred Nikki Blonsky in the lead role, and Harvey Guillen played queer kid Alistair, or Athena, going by both names, as we'll talk about. The following is an essay focusing on Harvey Guillen's character, written originally at the time, around 2011, for Anita Brady's class, Media, Gender and Sexuality at Victoria University of Wellington, which was the best undergrad course ever. At the time, I published this piece on Facebook and got positive responses from both Guillen himself and other cast members, which reflected the close engagement between the huge cast and fandom at that time, because it was one of those quite smaller fandoms and smaller shows where therefore there's kind of a closer relationship between people involved in production and the fandom. Fortunately, sort of short-lived, because it only lasted a season. And just a note before we begin, the essay is academic, and there's one term I should define. So interpolation, which is a term I use, it refers to the way a person can be called by power to identify a certain way. So in Louis Althusser's classic example, a police officer calls someone, and by turning around, they identify themselves as a guilty subject. So interpolation is the way power hails a subject. And this essay will be talking partly about the interpolation of queerness and Huge. So with that in mind, here's the essay. It's like they brought a present for the person they wish you were, which is a quote from Guillen's character, Huge and the Limits of Marketable Queerness. ABC Family show Huge disrupts and reinforces norms of gender and sexuality on network television. The basis for this show was laid through the sale and diversification of the Family Channel, leading to experimentation with new audiences. The choice to focus on a largely plus-size cast in a romantically charged teen drama was a commercially risky endeavor. Textual analysis will focus particularly on the character of Alistair Delgado, or Athena, who is interpolated on the terms of network television as, quote, the gay character, unquote, but whose negotiation with the production of sexuality and gender identity complexifies this type. The cancellation of this show and cutting short of Alistair or Athena's story reflects the limitations of the profit model as a basis for queer expression. So analysis will place the show in an economic context at one level and an interpolative context at another. So Judith Butler acknowledged in the 10th anniversary edition of Gender Trouble that gender transgression is often limited to its acquisition of exchange value. So you can transgress gender norms as long as it's profitable and compatible with the market, basically. So this essay will put Huge in historical and economic context as a network TV show produced through competition for new markets. Textual analysis will then focus on the portrayal of gender and sexuality in the show, particularly, quote, gay character, unquote, Alistair or Athena. So Alexander Doty and Ben Gove criticized the simplification to positive and negative depictions of LGBT characters because identification is more complex. It's not just a matter of positive identification. People have kind of negative experiences which they might identify with. This essay will attempt instead to place characters in the context of interpolation, the calling into being of a subject, particularly a gendered sexual subject, in this case by network television. So instead of being about positive representation, I'm talking about the response to the hail and the response to the call to identify, basically. Queerness in Huge is subject to the political economy of network television. ABC Family, the network for Huge, was originally known as the Family Channel, The Family Channel was an arm of Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network, one of America's 200 largest charities, an interesting definition of charity, which has around 95% donor dependency. This channel attracted largely older audiences, less sought by advertisers, so only a third of homes watching the channel had children. Pat Robertson sold the channel to Fox, who sought to draw in younger viewers. Finally, with Disney taking over, the channel rebranded as ABC Family, a new kind of family, seeking younger audiences and publicly distancing itself from Robertson's ultra-conservative rhetoric. The move towards a commercial model and the quest for new audiences formed the basis for Huge. Advertising is central to the political economy of mass media, and to get advertising dollars, networks must win audiences. ABC Family brought out a wide range of original programming for so-called millennial audiences. So producer Robin Schiff helped arrange a collaboration between student Savannah Dooley and her mother Winnie Holzman on a teen drama set at a fat camp. Dooley stated that she was frustrated by the lack of body diversity on TV and eager to do something new and interesting. The showrunners found that casting the show was a challenge because of the limitations Hollywood places on actors' bodies. In an interview just before the premiere, lead actress Nikki Bonsky speculated that it might be the first full plus-size cast in the history of TV. By its premise, the show was disrupting previous bodily norms on network television. The advantages of the network's liberalization were double-edged. As Family gained new audiences with a series of hit shows, the ratings threshold increased, creating a more competitive environment for shows like Huge. With ratings averaging 1.9 million, the show was cancelled despite positive critical and fan reception. Increased competition both opened the room for the show as an experiment in market expansion and closed it when the experiment failed, at least relative to other competitors. The show did find a strong online following for its critical politics of fat, sexuality, and gender. Savannah Dooley, the creator, has stated that some of her inspiration was drawn from fat-positive blogs. In turn, Dooley was interviewed about the show on a number of blogs, and Fashionista ran a series of largely favorable recaps. Bloggers have argued the show's body politics break from the usual limitations of network television. The show deliberately disrupts and negotiates norms of gender and sexuality. An ABC press release describes lead character Will, played by Nikki Blonsky, as, quote, a menace to some and a revolutionary to others, unquote. As she constantly challenges the whole concept of a fat camp and the normative ideals imposed on women's bodies. In the opening scene, she performs a partial striptease, disrupting normative media depictions of fat women as passive and asexual. Will describes herself openly as an angry feminist and makes a mural on her bunkroom wall saying, "Screw body fascism." She is mistaken within the text for a lesbian due to her unconventional gender presentation. In interviews, Savannah Dooley has contrasted this with her own experience that people incorrectly assume she's straight because her presentation is more femmy. Dooley has stated that everything I write is queer. Rather than interrogating the authenticity of this queerness, Alistair Delgado, a character understood as gay, has particularly complex negotiation with interpolations of gender and sexuality, and this, of course, is the character played by Harvey Guillen. Arguably, they are not the only LGBT plus character. So one character identifies as asexual, and some audiences have read Will's platonic girlfriend as having a crush on her. However, Alistair is the character most interpolated as non-hetero. A secondary character, Alistair has been referred to by some cast members and media commentators as the gay character. Alistair never actually comes out or identifies as gay, but is still hailed as such. Many have noted the heavy expectations placed on the performance of coming out as gay. It could be argued Alistair never has a coming out scene precisely because they remain in the closet. Indeed, in the finale, they must perform heterosexuality for their parents. However, their interactions with their peers are more complicated than that, reflecting tensions around interpolation and assumption. Characters within the show refer to Alistair as that gay kid, making sense of their effeminacy and perhaps their crush on jock character Trent by hailing them as gay. When somebody finally asks Alistair directly if they're gay, they respond, quote, "I don't really think of it like that. I don't like labels," close quote. This turns the coming out narrative on its head because rather than having to tell people they're gay, Alistair has to explain that it's more complicated when they assume that they're gay. Writer Savannah Dooley has said that she intended to explore the grey areas of sexuality. So, quote, "I get why Alistair's crush on Trent might leave the impression that Alistair is gay despite his words, 'I don't think of it like that,' because your viewers are used to seeing sexuality as fixed, straight or gay, nothing in between. I'm interested in exploring the grey areas, especially in a teen show where the characters are still figuring out how to label themselves and what they even want," close quote. Alistair's body does not conform to media ideals of gay masculinity in terms of size or colour. So Rosalind Gill notes that media often signifies gay masculinity not through sexual preference but through presentation. Quote, "Gay men are signified primarily through stylish and attractive appearance and patterns of looking. Indeed, it often seems as if gay masculinity is primarily a style identity, not a sexual one," close quote. While they are certainly camp, Alistair does not fit network standards of conventional attractiveness. On top of their weight, they have body odor issues related to their fear of showering with boys, and weight has been associated with abjection and grotesque camp, that which is rejected to maintain order. Actor Harvey Guillen and actors cast as Alistair's family are also Spanish-American in an environment where 80% of LGBT characters are white, according to GLAAD in 2011. So Alistair's body is unusual in a number of ways for a regular on network television. Alistair also flirts with gender variance and can be read as genderqueer. At a basic level, the character does not fit into masculine gender norms. In one scene early on, Alistair complains that their parents bought them a masculine G.I. Joe rather than the feminine Sky Dancer dolls they brought their sister. And they conclude, quote, "It's like they brought a present for the person they wish you were," close quote, which personally for me is one of the most resonant descriptions I've ever heard of queerness and the sort of disjuncture you sometimes feel as a queer person between social expectations and sort of your own response to them. The line, "It's like they brought a present for the person they wish you were." But beyond not fitting masculine norms, Alistair also shows an attraction to feminine identification and presentation. Their attraction to Trent is first indicated through a longing gaze while Trent is dressed in drag. Later, they must choose a new name as part of Spirit Quest, an appropriated Native American rite of passage. And they choose the name Athena. This is around the halfway period of the show. So throughout the show, from then on, they respond variously to both names, taking particular satisfaction from Trent using the name Athena. The character's apparent shifts between identification as Alistair and Athena could be interpreted multiple ways, but it's not hard to see it as gender fluidity, defined as moving between two or more genders. This is one form of genderqueer identity. And genderqueer people, those who don't identify solely with one gender, face even greater discrimination than binary trans folk. Research shows that gender non-conforming youth in the US are widely targeted for abuse. Alistair could be understood as a rare point of identification for gender variant youth in a TV environment where transgender characters are virtually non-existent. And this was written about 10 years ago, and it actually has started to shift a little, but only a little. In its most overt portrayals of teenage sexuality and hedonism, the show tactically mediates between normativity and complication. So the episode Birthdays, with its underage drinking and same-sex kisses, has to be careful to stay network-friendly. Dooley and Holzman talk in the commentary about how network regulations force them to be creative in their portrayal of teenage drinking. Arguably, the same-sex kisses are managed in a similarly tactical way with the network in mind. For the first same-sex kiss, two popular girls, Chloe and Amber, kiss as a drunken dare. Many have noted how so-called girl-on-girl kisses are often constructed cynically for the male gaze as the most marketable form of same-sexuality. In this case, following convention, the show cuts away to male reaction shots, explicitly affirming the male gaze. So the first same-sex kiss in the show is fairly normative for network TV. This paves the way for the second kiss. Chloe dares Dante to kiss another boy. However, in this case, this dare ends up as a prank on unsuspecting Alistair, whereas the previous one was both characters were in the know. In this case, it's a sort of a prank. And the boy's same-sex kiss is more complicated, particularly with Alistair's refusal and negotiation of norms. So commentators have noted how kisses between men are marginalized on network TV, and when they are depicted, they're often safely passionless, which also plays out in this case. Additionally, the camera cuts away to a girl cupping her face in shock, reinforcing that these kisses are performed for a heteronormative gaze, not for homosexual pleasure. However, Alistair complicates this dynamic. Before the kiss, they're trying to explain that they don't identify as gay or straight. After Dante kisses them, Alistair apologetically responds, "I like someone else." For a moment, Dante loses the upper hand. Not only is Alistair refusing the schoolyard interpolation that the gay kid will happily kiss any boy, they also assume Dante is experiencing unrequited attraction to them. Somewhat weakly, Dante responds, "It was a joke, dude," and the other bullies emerge from their hiding place laughing and jeering. Pained music and reaction shots indicate that the kiss is problematic, but yeah, there's an interesting turn of the tables there where Alistair or Athena in a sense refuses the come on of the other character, whereas there's this assumption that the gay kid will be into it regardless. And the fallout from this party gone wrong deepens the themes of bodily insecurity and negotiations of gender and sexuality. So Birthdays is actor Harvey Guillen's favourite episode of the series and is a turning point for their character. It's significant that Chloe and Alistair, who are twins, perform the two problematic same-sex kisses. The identification between the twins is fraught with anxieties around relational existence and bodily autonomy. Butler argues that, quote, "Part of understanding the oppression of lives is precisely to understand that there is no way to argue away the condition of a primary vulnerability," close quote. meaning partly that we are all connected by our vulnerability as bodies, people who were born. Our necessary relational existence prevents total bodily autonomy. Alistair and Chloe's most emotionally charged confrontation occurs on their shared birthday, an indication of primary shared vulnerability. Quoting Butler again, birth is the vulnerability that precedes the formation of the I, close quote. Up to this episode, Chloe is ashamed of Alistair and keeps it a secret that they are twins, but she tries to prevent the prank and breaks down when it's enacted. The betrayal in this scene breaks previous notions of kinship, which were already strained. The scene narrows on a series of close-ups of Alistair and Chloe as they meet each other's gaze. Alistair places their hand on their mouth as if feeling for a lost limb. This is their first kiss, and both their sense of relational existence or kinship and their bodily autonomy have been violated. One blogger describes Alistair's expression as surprisingly dark in this scene, because previously the character was emotionally positive and open towards Chloe. It's probably just worth noting here that since this episode is kind of following Harvey Guillen's track from his first role to his more recent one, that this is a really good example of just how fantastic an actor that Harvey Guillen is. He was much younger at this point, but it was very apparent at this point that he was a really excellent actor. And it's a real sign of how shitty Hollywood is that Harvey Guillen didn't get more roles after this.
Definitely, when it comes to same-sex male kissing, still to this date, not unlike if you look at interracial kissing, going all the way back to if you look at the one on Star Trek, it's always like closed mouth, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of a peck on the cheek almost when you get kisses between men. Yeah, I think that's true. So he was 20 at the time. Yeah, he's playing a teenager. He's obviously not a teenager, but he's still quite young, and like in any case, he is very, very good in that role. Like he was a really obvious standout at that point, and you know, I personally followed him, you know, as a fan on social media ever since, and watched his sort of various minor roles and random comedies and stuff until he finally got a real breakthrough role in What We Do in the Shadows.
I notice a parallel with Wilson Cruz's career as well, from him being on, coincidentally enough, on My So-Called Life. I did not know the connections here. And, you know, that was very groundbreaking when I was in high school and on MTV. And you had, you know, Wilson Cruz playing this groundbreaking gay character on the show. And if you kind of look at it, it was like, and he acted the shit out of that. And like, where was he for a while? And it's good to see that he's on Star Trek Discovery now.
Oh, I completely missed that connection. That's the guy from My So-Called Life. That's good to know. It's quite similar to Huge in a lot of ways. I mean, they both have this kind of worthy issue of the week feeling, even I think even more so in My So-Called Life. I think that's one element of it that's a bit cheesy, is it's so issue of the week, but it's really good and really like really progressive. And yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, the intergenerational element of like of Holzman collaborating with Dooley on her show. And it's a real shame Dooley hasn't gotten to create more things as well. But yeah.
And unfortunately too, I would say, even if like, if you even, you know, if you removed all the queer aspects of the show and it was just a show just on the fat positivity alone, that probably would have killed it too, and it would have lasted just as long, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it is essentially the lack of, you know, interest in a show about kids at a fat camp that got it cancelled. I don't think it, like the, you know, the argument I make in the essay is I don't think it was cancelled because of the depiction of queerness. I think it was cancelled because this particular kind of unusual depiction of queerness wasn't marketable. And a large part of that is simply that, you know, fat bodies were not seen as marketable. So it's kind of that queer expression is limited to what can be profitable.
And this profitability that is very double-edged, because, you know, a show like this that I probably would have loved to have seen originally when it was on the air, I think I probably was turned off from it, not knowing enough about it because of how it was marketed, because of all the bad fat camp movies throughout my life that have always been on. And that here is one that's really turning that on its head and really doing something new and unique here and going even further than the fat positivity. And I really missed out. And I'm glad you sent it to me for Christmas.
Yeah. I bought Derek a DVD. Unfortunately, this is a very hard show to find and online. You really have to buy the DVD. So I brought Derek a DVD for Christmas. But yeah, I mean, this was something Dooley also discussed, that people were really wary of the show. And when they heard it was called Huge, they sort of said, well, would you make a show about LGBT characters called queer? And Dooley said, yeah, I'd absolutely do that. That sounds fantastic. That's a show I want to make.
I think that might have been part of it. I think I might have remembered that at the time of thinking, oh, that's kind of not cool to have a show where you finally have some kids who have some realistic body weights and stuff, and then you call it Huge.
Yeah, it's a bit edgy, and there are definitely elements of the show that are edgy in that way, but I think it is very much on the side of the angels, as it were. Another interesting tidbit about Savannah Dooley, it's kind of tangential, but she has a full Daria outfit. If you look up some of her interviews, she actually dresses in like a full Daria cosplay, essentially. So I think that kind of tells you a bit in that she is... You know, Daria was always a bit of an edgelord on the side of the angels as well, so I think calling it Huge was edgy, but it's definitely like quite explicitly, you know, siding with fat positivity. I mean, the lead, you know, I focus here on Alistair because, you know, he's the character who's most interesting to me, and in large part because he's queer, honestly. But the lead, Will, is also, you could say a lot about her and the fact that she's openly feminist. You know, she calls herself an angry feminist and is completely opposed to the entire concept of the fat camp. And there's sort of a struggle over the course of the series over whether she will accept the fat camp, and she never really does. And there's a number of points where, like, as a viewer, if you're critical of fat negativity, number of points where you might get suspicious that, like, that they're going in a direction of her learning an important lesson, that actually fat camps are a good thing, but they never cross that line, which is nice. But then, I mean, it's a very complex show because it also has characters who are there willingly, you know. It doesn't sort of portray it like every character was just forced to be there and hates the whole thing. There are characters who believe that they should be there and that it's healthy and good for them to be there and volunteered to go. I mean, it's a drama, you know, it's not a sort of a Brechtian political epic or what have you. So it does have, you know, a range of kind of perspectives that characters have, but I think it definitely sort of sides with a more sort of resistant view on gender and sexuality.
Well, how is the curriculum and the adults running the place in the facility, and whoever's behind the facility, how is that portrayed? Is it like they're just like trying to get kids to have a unhealthy kind of weight and just trying to guilt them into losing weight and stuff? Because I've experienced, I've been around situations where they just send your kids who could be overweight, queer, even just being a goth, and send you to a mental institution. And, you know, this kind of reminds me of, like, is this kind of, like, barely into, like, ex-gay camp or, you know, gay therapy territory?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've followed some of the stuff Paris Hilton recently has been like, exposing around all of the bizarre kind of culty camps and, like, exploitative institutions that kids get sent to of all
sorts. That's interesting.
It's actually, I would say, actually, a lot of the show is more like any kind of summer camp show. Like, it does deal with the politics of that, but, like, a lot of the activities we see them doing are just general summer camp activities, and a lot of the time, it is essentially just a teen soap at a summer camp where it just happens that most of the cast is plus size. But there's times when they go into more of the sort of the, you know, as you put it, curriculum of it. Like, there's one episode which is like a weigh-in episode, you know, where they all measure their supposed progress. And that episode is like, I think it's one of the most powerful episodes of the series because, you know, you see, you know, people's sense of like either they've exceeded what they expected or they haven't met their target. And you see the sort of the emotional impact of that, and like one of the more interesting characters actually, who I don't talk about and may say at all, is I forget her name, but she's a character who's a blonde girl who's probably the most sort of conventionally attractive person in the show, and she is what I've heard described as Hollywood fat. So in other words, by normal everyday life standards, she isn't necessarily what you'd think of as a particularly big person, but by the standards, you know, Hollywood body, body standards, she's Hollywood fat. And that's directly commented on in the show, and Will sort of because Will is very confrontational to a fault, directly sort of points that out. And she's there voluntarily, and she doesn't meet her target. And so we see her sort of body, essentially her sort of sense of shame and looking at herself in the mirror because she hasn't met her target, which is like, you know, very disturbing because she's a character who's not clinically obese or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But because she hasn't met this target, you know, she has this sense of shame. And with her character, it's pretty clear that it's a disorder. So, I mean, yeah, so I think it is critical, but
it doesn't sound like a boot camp or anything, or some of the behavioral modification kind of camps that we have. Yeah,
it's more, a lot of the show is more, as I say, a teen soap opera set at a summer camp where it just happens that a lot of the cast is plus size. And I kind of zero in on some of the social themes, but a lot of it is just relationship drama and, you know, just the stuff you get at any kind of summer camp show. Mm-hmm. It does also go into more intense territory, and it tends to be the more intense territory that I'm more interested in. But
so it's not so much like you have a boot camp and a drill sergeant like military school.
There's a little bit of that. There's a funny part with a trainer type who is basically everyone sees him as incredibly hot, and he has sort of a whistle and has them doing jogging around. And what's particularly funny in that sequence is that everyone's expecting this sort of awful hardball character, and then it's this really hot guy. And all the girls are kind of really into it. And then the cutaway to Alistair is like perfectly, you know, in keeping with that. And that's one of the sort of nice early hints of Alistair being queer, you know, when you have all the girls reacting a certain way and then you have the cutaway to Alistair reacting in exactly the same way. There's a lot of really like beautiful little moments like that with Alistair where they're just constantly getting at the fact that he's, you know, that he's, they are queer. This is a thing, by the way. I used he pronouns here, and it's an interesting question because when I first wrote this essay, I used he pronouns, and that was because in the show, Alistair does use he pronouns and never explicitly like says that they identify as non-binary or trans or anything. But at a certain point in the series, being already clearly a queer character, they adopt the name of Athena in like an alternating basis. So now in this, and you know, in this, I'm updating the essay. I've been using they pronouns, whereas I used he at the time. And at the time, I actually had a footnote explaining that in the show, the character uses he pronouns.
I was wondering if they settled on different pronouns by the end of the show.
This is the thing, is that the character is quite clearly still in the process of figuring this out. Like, and the show was cancelled after one season. So there's not like a final settled thing of this is what this character's identity is. And also, I mean, because part of the point is that the character does not necessarily fit into binary labels or is not necessarily fully comfortable with binary labels. And then you combine that with the fact that they're a teenager and still figuring themselves out. So, you know, you know, as much as there's definitely some kind of gender diversity going on here, you know, there's not a settled sort of identity that Alistair or Athena definitely has by the end. So, yeah, I mean, I've more recently shifted to using they pronouns, but the character at no point in the series says, you know, I'm non-binary and use they pronouns, which, you know, I mean, Star Trek Discovery is the only show I can think of where anyone does that. Anyway, I guess the thing with Huge is, even though it doesn't explicitly settle on a sort of identity for Alistair, and I don't feel it has to, especially in the first season and when you're showing character development, despite that, it is very ahead of its time. To have a teen show with a basically all plus-size cast is one thing, but then you also have, you know, a character who's figuring out their gender identity and who's attracted to men and being male assigned at birth. You have an asexual character, and I mean, you asked also about the nature of the camp and whether the camp is portrayed negatively, I guess. And there's an interesting aspect of that, which is that the person who runs the camp, who's played by Gina Torres from Firefly, she is actually somebody who supposedly has lost weight through a fat camp in the past. But she's portrayed as still having an eating disorder. So it's kind of interesting. It's a sympathetic portrayal of her, but it also kind of implies that she has a disorder which she's then projecting onto the kids and maybe almost encouraging that they adopt similar sort of problematic things that have hurt her, that she's passing that trauma on. It's kind of implied, it's a drama, and it's a drama that sort of portrays a lot of different sort of perspectives. Yeah. So it's not like it's outright saying, you know, this person is a you know, reactionary who's, you know, body fascist. Although Will does basically call her a body fascist, but that's Will as, you know, being Will as a character kind of thing. You know, like it's not a didactic show particularly. It's a sort of dramatic more so. But I think it, you know, I think, you know, if nothing else, it does things that you don't often see on network TV.
There was the possibility, and there was the word that you can't prove this 100% either way, that possibly the asexual character was inspired by Ivy's Letters to an Asexual video on YouTube, as far as the creators learning about asexuals, more than Ivy being the direct inspiration. But who knows?
It's quite possible, because, you know, it's quite clear that Savannah Dooley was aware of sort of the online, very, you know, online LGBT and, you know, fat positive and various kind of representational politics sphere online in terms of, you know, blogs and various other media. So, yeah, it's quite possible that is where she got the inspiration. So that could be a connection between last week's guest and this week's episode. With that scene where Alistair is kissed as sort of a prank and is, you know, this sort of does damage to their relationship with other characters. So previously, you know, Alistair's been very emotionally open and very positive, but after this point, Alistair starts to harden towards certain characters. So particularly towards Chloe, who's Alistair's twin, where Chloe was basically pretending that Alistair, you know, didn't exist and wasn't her cousin, and Alistair was always open to her. And at this point, that kind of switches around where, and after the kiss, Alistair turns away, and it's this very sort of dramatic moment where their relationship is kind of denied, and that remains the case where Alistair is very sort of cold towards Chloe for the rest of the series, understandably. The same with Alistair towards Dante, who carried out the supposed prank. Where Alistair treats Dante with disdain, and Dante is actually trying to win Alistair back and try to win their friendship back. When he tries to make amends by using the name Athena, Alistair replies, "Yeah, don't call me that," which is, you know, interesting because Alistair otherwise appreciates the name Athena. Contradictory using both words in the same sentence, but. Point being, there's a contextual use of the name Athena, and the character particularly enjoys when Trent, who they have a crush on, uses the name Athena for them. But when it comes to somebody like Dante, who Alistair does not see as a friend, basically. They refuse the name Athena and say, don't call me that. So this is kind of again, like with the refusing the label of gay, they're also, again, refusing the name even they have chosen, Athena, which I think is another kind of refusal of interpolation. So basically denying their peers the ability to sort of categorize them in some way. Alistair at this point very much hardens towards people who are not, who have violated their sense of bodily autonomy. But Alistair also asserts a positive sense of identification. So in the closing scene of Birthdays, Alistair expresses desire for Trent, who was the first to respect their new identification, and who has tried to support them. Although actually Trent, you know, in the manner of a teen soap opera, is actually in a relationship with their cousin Chloe. So they're into their cousin's boyfriend. But Alistair's love becomes more conditional, toughening towards Chloe and Dante. And Butler argues that the constitution of a queer subject is interpolated by abuse. So in other words, queer people or subjects come into being in part through experiencing abuse. That's part of how queer identity kind of forms. So in the wake of trauma, Athena seeks to assert themselves anew. Their closing scenes in the finale consist of making and publicly wearing a new outfit. They cut their neckline wider and wear a necklace. Both items come from women, so the neckline idea is borrowed from lead character Will, and the necklace is borrowed from a visiting mother who loses it in the male bunk room. And through these borrowed items, their production of their self is strongly relational, particularly identified with women. However, as I've said, Alistair never explicitly comes out with a fixed identity. Alistair is not necessarily a woman misidentified as a man or necessarily a man attracted to men. this teenager is still negotiating interpolations of gender and sexuality. So it could be, for example, that Athena is a drag persona rather than the person that, you know, that this character wants to be permanently known as. It's just not fixed or clear at this point.
See, that's what I meant in my comments about my questions about rose quartz.
Right. I think with rose quartz, we just have less information than we do. You know, in the case of Steven Universe, we have more information about Steven. But with Steven, you know, it takes Steven 5 seasons each with lots of episodes because, God, those Cartoon Network, there's a lot of episodes. But, like, it takes Steven 5 seasons to really work out any kind of a coherent identity. And Huge was cancelled after 1 season, not to mention, you know, this character I'm talking about isn't the lead. You know, they're one of a large ensemble. So, yeah, they don't really get an opportunity to figure all of this out. It's, it's one of those just tragic cancellations. So the cancellation of Huge underlines the limitations of commercial production as a basis for queer expression. Doty notes the normative way same-sex relationships are portrayed in major network shows such as Modern Family, with the good gays aspiring to a monogamous nuclear family. This limitation was expressed more bluntly when out gay pop star Adam Lambert performed a kinky rendition of For Your Entertainment, and along with advertisers pulling out, gay marriage activist Jennifer Venasco rebuked Lambert for not affirming the image of good gays who have families and jobs and bills and weddings.
What?
Marcuse's notion of repressive tolerance may have some relevance here. Diversity and even some dissent are tolerated within the range and limits of the prevailing society. In the case of network TV, the limits of exchange value or profitability or perceived potential profitability, because a lot of it also is that network executives perceive risk. So it's not even necessarily just what's profitable, but what's seen as potentially jeopardizing or risking profit. And Alistair's mind and body fall outside these limits. So while Huge was not cancelled because of its depiction of gender and sexuality, it was cancelled because its depiction of gender and sexuality were not sufficiently marketable. So in conclusion, Huge has a contradictory relationship with the norms of network television. Its existence was enabled by the sale and rebranding of the Family Channel from an arm of a nominally non-profit Christian media empire to an explicitly for-profit network seeking younger audiences. ABC's Family's demand for new audiences opened up possibilities for previously marginalized bodies in terms of fat, gender, and sexuality. The show internalizes contradictions between queer exploration and the norms of network television, with so-called gay character Alistair refusing and negotiating interpolation. Finally, the cancellation of Huge reinforces network norms. Queer expression is limited to its acquisition of exchange value. That's the end of the essay.
Yeah, and I think bringing up the couple on Modern Family is a good point, because they weren't allowed to kiss for many, 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 many episodes. And even then, it was like on the cheek or closed mouth or anything. And that show was like being given all these props for being, you know, so modern and you know, having gay characters and stuff. And the gay characters weren't even allowed to kiss in that first season. You know, I think ironically, the show might have lasted a little bit longer in ABC Family's new iteration, Freeform, but it probably would have hit the same walls that you describe here in your piece.
Yeah, I haven't gotten around to Modern Family, have you?
Nah, it's I don't find it very entertaining.
Yeah, it did seem fairly bland to me, but I've been meaning to try it out.
It seems like it's both bland and trying too hard at the same time.
Yeah. But just to wrap up on Huge, as I've said, it's a bit difficult to get your hands on, but it's well worth buying the DVD if you're interested in affirming, queer-friendly teen melodrama, although also often very intense. I mean, it gets into some dark territory, so be aware of that. But overall, I think it's a very sort of affirming show. And as I've said, after it concluded, I followed Harvey Guillen's career with interest. And frankly, while he blossomed as a male model, he deserved much better roles than he was getting for a long time acting-wise. So it's fantastic to see all his work finally pay off with his prominent role in What We Do in the Shadows.
But can't you see I'm calling? A guy like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous. I'm falling.
This is a sitcom about vampires based on a short and feature by the brilliant Taika Waititi. And it's also perfect that this show is so queer, with characters being bi by default. So, yeah, Derek, did you have any thoughts on What We Do in the Shadows?
Yeah, I did not see the short, I don't think, originally. I saw the mockumentary at first. Then I was pleasantly surprised when it got adapted to television. And it was a great movie and a great adaptation. And I think the Mark Mothersbaugh's choice of music is brilliant. All this death-related music, especially the theme song. And I really love the choice of public domain art and occult images that go with the episodes and that are mixed into scenes, where sometimes they'll use Photoshop to put the characters' faces onto like drawings to make them look like they've been around for thousands of years or hundreds of years or whatever. And I think that's pretty cool. You know, I also kind of keep an eye out. You know, they clearly went all in with all the vampire connections with vampire genre and movies and TV shows. And I definitely think that there's the obvious Guillermo del Toro connections with a familiar named Guillermo and a frequent collaborator with del Toro, Doug Jones, a very tall actor, played the Baron. And so this show has made really good use of actors at different points, and especially cameos. And I really loved the Vampire Council cameos, where you had different actors, big and small, who have played vampires over the years, playing themselves as vampires. And you had like Tilda Swinton, Danny Trejo, and the original three of the actors from the New Zealand mockumentary for What We Do in the Shadows, and you had Wesley Snipes there and Pee-wee Herman, who was in the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, and you had the actress that I hate to relate, I can't remember her name at the moment, to relate it to her being the one that really blew the lid off of how bad Marilyn Manson is. She was a vampire on True Blood. She played a character, and there's quite a few other cameos there. I really like that as a bookend, you know, especially if that was going to be all that there was, because I know there was a hell of a hiatus between seasons. So that was a great season finale, and especially for such a short season. And I understand they shot around the cameos to make sure that everybody could film their scenes later when they could. So they just filmed the episode as it was. And I really like how the show has gone from the kind of Christopher Guest mockumentary style in the movie to kind of carrying that over and doing like the British Office style or Parks and Rec, as we have here, where, you know, characters are being filmed in a documentary that we just never get to see. And we have hints that there's a camera crew. And there's always, I like that this show is bringing to light a lot of the cliches that are both in found footage movie and in fake documentaries that honestly, logically do not make sense about, like, when you have a film crew with you. And they've really called attention to that in several scenes in several different episodes. And then there's the episodes where they remind you that there's a film crew, like when the film crew gets killed or something happens to them.
That's something I find that I much prefer about this compared to something like Parks and Rec or the US Office. That honestly, I find both of those to be quite lazy in how they use the mockumentary form, and that nobody really actually thinks about them as mockumentaries because they're not. Like, they use the mockumentary format as a shortcut to give a sense of people's inner lives, but there's really much sort of self-consciousness or awareness of camera. And whereas I think, as you say, the original movie, What We Do in the Shadows, was more of the Christopher Guest-style mockumentary. And I think this the TV show is similar in that there's more references to the fact that it's a mockumentary and more awareness of the fact that the characters are being shot. So I find it a lot less lazy as a use of the mockumentary form compared to a lot of the sitcoms that have kind of adopted that style.
Because I mean, you bring that up too, that in both the Office, it's never explained that why is this happening? Why are there the cutaways? Whereas in the British version, there was a camera crew, and I believe. And then when you look at Modern Family, they do it too. They just mug for the camera for no particular reason. And I think WandaVision really called attention to this very well too, about how the hell are these interstitions happening? You know, it's like if you're in the middle of a scene, how does the scene stop? And then you're sitting and talking to the camera crew in the same scene. It doesn't make any sense, literally.
A lot of these shows, I think the cutaway, the interview cutaway, like, it serves a similar purpose to what narration traditionally has done. And people say, oh, narration is a bad technique. And, you know, there was that joke in the movie adaptation where they like never use narration, and that's interspersed with the lead character's narration. And in shows like Parks and Rec and The Office, they're like, they just use these cutaways for essentially the same purpose. It's like it's a shortcut to get to people's inner lives, and I just find it so lazy when there's no other sort of references to the fact that the camera crew is there. The only sort of reference to it is the shortcut to get what people are really thinking.
I find it very similar to the cutaways in Family Guy, really, when you think about it. It's like it's non sequitur. It does not fit with the rest of the style of how the shows are made. Does Brooklyn Nine-Nine do that style as well, or no? Do they look at the camera?
I think some of the shooting style is similar, but I don't think they're not leaning into the idea that it's a mockumentary. Like, you don't have the interviews and stuff, but some of the filming style is similar, but I guess that's more the sort of cop show sort of pseudo realism element, I would say, probably. But yeah, I mean, What We Do in the Shadows, I think it has more of that cringe comedy element of like Christopher Guest, the UK Office, and like early US Office before it became a more generic sitcom. And I think a lot of that cringe comedy is the sort of self-consciousness of people in front of the camera and just how ridiculous and or unself-conscious sometimes that people can be in front of a camera. There's a lot of jokes.
And it always has that problem that I have with found footage movies is how was the camera crew there for certain scenes that the camera crew wasn't there for? They make more questions than they have answers in that regard.
I don't know. I still reckon this show does it a lot better than most sitcoms.
Oh, yeah. And I think they're doing it very tongue-in-cheek and really breaking the fourth wall as they do it.
Yeah, they seem to, it's like they actually remember that it's a mockumentary. A lot of the mm-hmm. time in the Office and Parks and Rec, it's like they just don't even seem to remember that that's the format. Like, it just strikes me as lazy. But
one of my favorite parts was when Doug Jones's Baron reacted to the film crew, and then he bit the sound guy or something. That I just could not stop laughing, because it's like, for after a while, you know, I forgot that they were there, you know.
Yeah. Well, see, and this is the exactly the thing, is when they introduce new characters, they will notice the cameras, and that's one thing that pretty much never happens in Parks and Rec in the US Office. Like, nobody really notices the camera until they're doing their, like, their direct-to-camera, you know, asides. Whereas, you have a lot more, you know, as well as the leads sort of referencing the crew, you also have more people sort of wondering why they're being filmed and that. So, yeah, I find it a lot more enjoyable in that respect, and a lot less lazy. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think it reaches the heights of its absurdity when they go into the inner sanctums of the other vampires and stuff, and like when they went to the vampire council, and they're just like, oh yeah, we're just filming here, you know. I'm pretty sure vampires are pretty strict on the not letting everybody know we're vampires, just as much as they are on not killing other vampires or not making babies into vampires, et cetera, et cetera. So I find it hilarious that they just tolerate that these three loser vampires are just allowing themselves to be filmed by a documentary crew. And just exposing the fact that vampires of all sorts and supernatural beings exist.
Well, again, I mean, the whole Christopher Guest style of comedy, it's all about a lack of self-awareness. I mean, and that is also just in general, like a lot of what the humor in the show is based around is just the lack of awareness of like, in general, modern society, or just, you know, norms and technologies and pop culture. Like, these are people who are just completely disconnected. And that kind of brings us to Harvey's character, Guillermo, who's Nandor's familiar, because he kind of acts as the one person a lot of the time who has any kind of sense of how the world works.
I have asked Guillermo to bring me his computing machine so I can see if I have received any electronic letters in the past decade.
Okay.
Ah, yes.
This. Right, there you go.
And, like, does a lot of the work to make sure that they actually get away with things, or even able to just live a kind of a
halfway. And it's always been my suspicion that he's the one that's actually paying the rent.
Yeah, I could see that. But yeah. And I mean, watching the show, it very much reminds me of why I fell for Harvey back when he was in Huge. And it's not just because he's super cute. It's also because he's a brilliant actor, both comedically and dramatically. He's very funny, but there's also a lot of pathos and
the subtle looks.
Yeah, I found a quote from an article in The Advocate, which is called "Harvey Guillen is the queer human heart of What We Do in the Shadows," and it says, "In some ways, What We Do in the Shadows is also a metaphor for Hollywood. Guillermo endures degrading tasks that many assistants in showbiz can relate to, with the goal of one day being rewarded with power himself. However, instead of fetching dry cleaning and lattes, Guillermo is rounding up fresh virgins for his master to feast upon and then disposing of the bodies." Quoting Harvey himself, "It just feels like being in the entertainment industry and being short and queer and Mexican that I had strikes against me, because automatically the industry was saying there's not a real place for you." So he explicitly mm-hmm. acknowledges that that's kind of what the show is commenting on. And that that definitely resonates with one of the early scenes, because Guillermo initially wants to become a vampire, and the whole idea of being a familiar in this show is that you're being strung along and may eventually one day be promoted. It's like you're the intern, essentially. But he also says he wants to be a Latino vampire, and he cites Antonio Banderas as one of the few Latino vampires. So I thought that was kind of a nice kind of representation joke, like the first Latino vampire. But yeah, he's also, he is very queer, but the whole show is very queer. I mean, there's a lot of shipping of Guillermo with Nando, his master the word?
Master and familiar.
But like in general, all of the vampires are kind of polymorphously perverse. There's kind of the sense that and again, this is something that Guillen has explicitly said in interviews, that they kind of, the way they decided to play it was that the vampires, you know, distinctions of sexuality aren't such an issue because they're essentially big hedonists and just polymorphously perverse and will do anything.
Look, I was thinking
that we should finish each other off and tell no one.
Well, I'm game if you are.
Which is always kind of how I read a lot of contemporary vampires. I mean, like Anne Rice and, like, for example, Spike and Angel. I could always see the Spike and Angel ship, but not because they were like gay or bi so much as because they were polymorphously perverse kind of hedonists who had, you know, been living for a few centuries and, you know, would try anything.
And they knew each other. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that they have, and they have an intense bond similar to what a lot of the Anne Rice vampires do.
And I think, you know, one of the early signs there definitely of the kind of really poly attitude is you have both Laszlo and his wife Nadja separately talking about how they had sexual escapades with the Baron, and then the Baron later, he reveals that he has no genitalia, not unlike a Guillermo del Toro vampire in The Strain. And the vampires in The Strain, which are very similar to the vampires in Blade 2, it's kind of a continuation of that kind of design of a vampire, of being more of being parasites than sexy beings, you know, sexy seductresses and seducers, you know, like Dracula. These are beings that are disgusting, and their genitalia falls off. They have worms in their bodies that are able to carry the virus. They're highly, contagious. They literally release all of their bowels whenever they feed. I mean, he went through the whole very complicated biology of vampires in The Strain. And so here you have kind of vampires that are more of the classical style or the Anne Rice type. And I thought that was funny because, like, the Baron admits that, like, well, it's not that it's a title, it's something that he's called a Baron because he's barren in that he cannot sire other vampires. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, you think of infertility in humans and stuff. I mean, what does that mean to, like, immortal beings who cannot sire, you know, the equivalent of offspring? And I thought that was an interesting thing to have him kind of breaking down, you know, over drinks and drinking the blood of alcoholics and people at bars and people taking ecstasy at the clubs and then getting, you know, the secondary effects of that. That was one of my favorites. There was when they all got high after drinking the blood of people taking club drugs. But, like, yeah, I mean, the whole ideas of them, like, not being able to eat and everything. But then you have things like Laszlo and his copious ejaculation in the story, and you have things like the, you know, they're proud of their organizing orgies and everything, and so there's a lot of sexual fluidity there. And then, you know, here you had Guillermo being tasked to bring a virgin there, and of course he felt bad because it was his friend, and then the guy ends up having sex with the gimp, and he's no longer of the orgy, and he's no longer the prized virgin, and they have the worst orgy since Mike 150 years ago.
Yeah, but well, it's kind of a spectrum of vampires for sure. I mean, obviously these are the more classical Anne Rice-y kind of aristocratic, polymorphously perverse type vampires. But then you have various monstrous forms, and like then you have Colin, who's the energy vampire. And I thought some of the best satire was in the second season, where we have him essentially progress to middle management, and the idea of like management as the ultimate position for an energy vampire, I thought was a very, very good satire. And then soon after that, he, a troll as the ultimate energy vampire. So those were both, I think, very, very clever kind of satirical.
Yeah, he was able to feed by being a troll online, and then he meets the person online that's been sabotaging his trolling and feeding is an actual troll.
And I mean, so
we have other types of beings like in the documentary where they had werewolves. Here we have not only werewolves, but we have Babadooks. Now they introduced ghosts. That's one of my favorite episodes of the second season. Yeah, I loved Guillermo's reaction to that and telling them, he's like, you don't believe in ghosts after everything you all have seen? It's just like Guillermo was shining there, because he was like talking back to the vampires there, and it was really cool. And the episodes where he meets other familiars, it just gets darker and darker and sadder and sadder, and you kind of see him coming to this realization about the treatment and the fate of the familiars, and that they're never going to be turned. And we meet Andor's older familiar, who's an elderly man. You meet these other elderly familiars, and even the witches had the black goat as a familiar, who was in the similar situation, that figured, they're never going to turn us.
Which then kind of, it's an interesting thing, because at the same time, it's the internship thing. And it's also, there's an element of like a maybe unrequited love, although, Nando, there's this constant push and pull of Nando actually kind of emotionally needing him.
But I have been very unhappy since you left. I just want to know what I can do to bring you back home.
Oh. Well, I want to feel more respected and appreciated. And I want a day off.
But like every year?
No, Celeste would give us a day off each week.
What? She dresses herself that day? Like some cave pig? Eesh. Okay, fine, once a week.
And better snacks.
Which then kind of pulls him back. And just to get into spoilery territory, there's, the fact that he increasingly is becoming a vampire hunter, which then I think is interesting in that respect, because, he's been in this kind of subordinate position and in this position of essentially being strung along in terms of, both his sort of, I guess you could say, career, but also his emotional attachments. But he's actually low-key a threat. And we finally obviously get this revelation to the main cast at the end of the second season. So I guess we'll see where they go with that. But yeah, it's a kind of, he's put in a fairly unenviable position for a lot of the show. And to, obviously his increasing role as like a vampire hunter is kind of a bit of a turning of the tables, I guess. But
yeah, I really liked that, that episode where Guillermo took Nandor's DNA and did like a DNA test to see, how many descendants he had. And he had like, 200,000 descendants. And I love how Colin Ferguson kept rubbing in how many descendants Genghis Khan had, which is far manier. That he ends up meeting his American great by 30 removed, or by 30 granddaughter, however it works. Meets her and she dies because he tapped on the window. And everybody told him not to tap on the window like in Salem's Lot. And Salem's Lot definitely is, as well as Dracula, is a source for vampires having familiars or calling them as such, you know, because there's always been legends in Romania and other places that vampires need ghouls or werewolves or humans to watch their coffins during the daytime, you know, so somebody doesn't get them. And more modern movies started calling them familiars because witches have familiars, etc. And Blade really streamlined it, as well as the Salem's Lot books and movies. And there's a couple other movies in the 80s that had familiars as well. And just this idea that, you know, like Renfield was being, you know, dragged along by Dracula, that, well, you know, you keep serving me, I'm, you know, I'm gonna turn you, you know, and it's just a con, you know, because they just need a person to be able to watch them during the day. And I think that treatment there and that relationship and how we're seeing how unhealthy it is, and it kind of wonders why Guillermo, like, especially when he killed that one vampire at the vampire council, he still had a crucifix under his sweater. And I guess because he came from such a strong Catholic family, and why would somebody coming from such a strong Catholic background and everything, it's just like the example of Antonio Banderas in Interview with the Vampire was enough to get him to essentially be like a serial killer and the assistant to a serial killer, you know, and do the dirty work, you know, and then to want to be one. I think he was clearly deluding himself on some level, and it's just taken this long, and it took the course of the first season, really, and then finding out he was a Van Helsing, to realize that he doesn't want to be a vampire, and that's not something you really should be going for. And I don't see in any flashbacks or character development of why he wanted to be a vampire beyond surface explanations. And you kind of get to the point where he's been stuck doing it for like 10, 11 years. And it makes sense how it's wearing down on him. And you kind of wonder how strongly did he maybe really want to be a vampire? Did he just realize that vampires exist and was like so entranced by that he realized, I want to be a vampire too and never die and everything?
I took it as a very erotic thing, to be honest. I very much took it as, you know, that being a vampire is this, again, position of, you know, you think of Antonio Banderas, he's kind of a sex icon kind of thing. And The, you know, as I've said, there's a lot of shipping of Nando and Guillermo online. There's a lot of fan art of that. And there's a scene in season one where he kind of bares his neck wanting to be bitten, which I thought was very, yeah, I don't know. To me, it has to do with some kind of a queer desire. That's definitely what I associate it with. So, I mean, in terms of Catholicism, I mean, that's one of the many ways in which the vampires are outside of Catholicism. And, you know, like that, you know, we talked about the whole idea that vampires are polymorphously perverse. And I think that partly has to do with that sense of being outside a, you know, a Puritan or a Catholic morality, that if you can murder anyone, then what's the big deal with having sex with whoever you have sex with, kind of thing. Like, they're outside conventional standards of morality. But I took it as a kind of, as I said, I took it as a kind of erotic desire. I mean, I don't really see him taking up the vampire killer role as necessarily becoming a more of a moral character, even if the crucifix might help with that. I think of it as more as a way that he can now gain power. So basically, you know, he was in this position where he was hoping to gain more power, as a vampire, and he realizes he can't gain power that way. So to me, becoming a vampire hunter is some way that he can have some kind of power. I don't know. That's kind of how I took it. You know, in the towards the end of season two, he's sort of really playing to the camera, like quite explicitly, and when he carries out that massacre. But I don't know, and that, like, maybe like a sort of a vengeful element, which he doesn't quite want to admit to, because in some ways he is affectionate for like Nandor and stuff, but there is probably a bit of a like vengefulness underlying it as well, I guess.
Yeah, one of my favorite episodes was the one where he met actual rookie vampire hunters, and he ended up saving all their asses and killing all the vampires. I thought that was a brilliant episode. He's like Blade without trying, yeah, you know.
Well, I guess if we run with the idea that being a familiar is like being an intern, he kind of lucked into an alternative career he's good at. It just also turns out that potentially involves killing his boss.
How much do you think is kind of souring on being a vampire, or at least the vampire situation, is because he's living with three vampires, or four really, but the three that are immortals that we know of, that have basically squandered their lives and afterlives and really have just done nothing but sat around bitching as roommates that have not accomplished all the things they could have done with all those centuries of existence. And it kind of seems like, you know, he gets no respect from them, his master. He's called Gizmo all the time by them. or Guillermo, Biermo, you know, they don't even know
what his name is. Yeah.
But, you know, the whole thing is this real interesting kind of dysfunctional, toxic found family, whereas we kind of see other types of better versions of a non-toxic found family, you know, where you have these vampires that have come together that have the thing in common of being vampires, or being around the same time, or being on the same ship and being roommates and all this. And they kind of don't have a lot in common on other levels, except for some of the things, like you learn about the connections between Nadia and Nando in their past lives. And I really like the idea that the ghosts had unfinished business because they became vampires. And that was brilliant thinking of, like, vampires having ghosts independent of themselves. Whoever thought of that was like brilliant. The poor guy that keeps reincarnating himself and getting decapitated by Laszlo, and the revelation that Laszlo was actually the Jack the Ripper. And then, of course, he shows that he is a massive coward in season two when he goes on the run from Mark Hamill, of all people, who actually was a vocal fan of the movie and the show and was able to get on the show.
You mentioned the whole idea of the vampires as bad roommates, and I think they're kind of pathetic figures. I mean, I watched the short when it originally came out at a festival in New Zealand, and at that point and in the movie, it's very much an in-joke about essentially sad sack flatmates in Wellington, and I'm you know, I come from Wellington, New Zealand, and there are so many jokes in the short and the movie which are so Wellington specific and are about sort of either, you know, goths in Wellington or just bad flatmates in Wellington, and, like, you know, hipsters. And for example, I mean, there's a bar they visit to basically prey on, you know, prey on potential victims. And it's like the most, in my opinion, the most pathetic bar in Wellington at the time, which is now closed, which is basically the bar that all the first year university students go to, and the fact that that's their like haunt to find potential victims was just so funny. It was so sort of pathetic, and so I was initially a little bit put out that the US show was set in the US, because I thought the sense of humor in the short and the movie were so sort of New Zealand specific. I mean, I ended up really enjoying it and not minding, and I think they adapted it really well and still sort of caught that sense of the pathetic without necessarily having the same cultural references.
Setting it in Staten Island, I think, is a really good setting for them going to New York and being dumb enough to end up in Staten Island for centuries. That is such a smart joke.
I don't get that. Explain that one. See, that's a cultural reference. I don't get.
Basically, the boonies or the kind of racist and stupid area of New York. Let's say it's the New Jersey of New York.
So they managed to localize.
Actually, the guy who played Trump on the president show, he and his wife perfectly are people from Staten Island, because like Staten Island has a lot of cops live over there, and it's just very rural in an exurban way, and the people are very racist and provincial. So that, you know, the police that killed Eric Garner, you know, they had their trial out there, and you know, it was hard to find people guilty because they're so racist and pro-Trump and anti-black and everything. It's big, yeah. Trump country. People I know over there that do organizing, it's very difficult there because everybody's so reactionary. It's very different in that regard, and it makes sense. It's perfect that you would have vampires who are supposed to be sophisticated and smart or whatever, and they come to like the great New York, especially at like an earlier time of its height, you know. And where do they go? They go to Staten Island and they get stuck there.
Yeah, cosmopolitan creatures outside of Christian morality, and they go to the most conservative place in the area. Yeah, so I think they do a good job of localizing the kind of, yeah, the pathetic nature of the characters, which again comes back to that kind of cringe comedy thing. And the, I mean, Matt Berry is someone who's very good at that kind of comedy. So like, I think the Jackie Daytona episode, he gets to really have fun.
Oh, you're back. So, what is your name, stranger?
My name is Jackie.
Jackie Daytona.
And he's Matt Berry is also really great in Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. He just has a really amazing voice, but also a willingness to just be a bit ridiculous, which I think you need in a show like this.
Yeah, I think everybody is firing on all cylinders, you know, for a type of improv show like that. And I really think Harvey Guillen's really getting to really shine on this, and people are getting introduced to him, and maybe people who maybe slightly remember him from Huge, or people who are fans on Huge, are being reintroduced to him. And I think that he could get to other projects from here, but it's just hard to tell given the racism and homophobia of Hollywood still. Unfortunately, Latinos and Asian American actors just still, you know, can't make it that far. And let's face it, for Black actors, it hasn't gotten much further than Robert Townsend's movie, The Hollywood Shuffle, which I recommend to anybody to watch that movie about how it is to be Black in Hollywood. If you watch that now, not much has changed between then and the Oscars Are So White era here.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see him finally have a breakthrough, and a breakthrough in such a queer show as well. But yes, it is really unfortunate that, you know, that the capacity to sort of tell queer stories and to tell, you know, the stories of queer people who aren't Anglo-Saxon and so on is so limited by executives and executives as gatekeepers. And I think we very much wish Harvey Guillen good fortune in his future endeavors.
Yes, we do. And I really feel like with this, it's Steven Universe and a lot of the cartoons after that, I've really felt like a lot of television and movies in the last 5-6 years has been moving in a light speed pace of acceptance of queer people. And unfortunately, the backlash since the election of Donald Trump has really narrowed that at once feeling of opening and almost endless horizons and endless permutations and ways of expressing sexuality and gender. And it kind of feels like that door is being shut on us all again. And I think we got to keep things like this going, even if we just have to sneak things into TV shows and cartoons. Mm-hmm. All right. So as always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. And if you don't have the cash, a review at Apple Podcast also helps. Have a gay day, and we'll see you in the future.